hope you're all okay with that.
Now being recorded.
Great. So hello again. My name is Han Chu. I'm the Global Warming Solutions Manager for the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs. I manage and direct the policy planning and progress tracking for the climate mitigation policies for the Commonwealth. And I do a lot of coordination with other state agencies. And to my right, Claire, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure.
Yeah, hi everyone. I'm Claire Maciolik. I am the Decarbonization Study Manager, and I work with Han on the study that is looking out to 2050, and we're going to be talking about today and what we can do.
Great. And so we have a presentation for you all today, but before we dig into it, we just want to note a few logistical things first. Bathrooms, men's and women's, are to your right here. Men's will be to the right and going up the little hill near the food court, and then the women's to your right and then right around to the side. And then we have a sign-in sheet here for those who haven't pre-registered. If you could sign in, that'd be great. And for those who are pre-registered, we can just check your name off. And then lastly, we have drinks and snacks. Feel free to help yourself throughout the session. Okay, so through the next 40 minutes or so, we will present on the Global Warming Solutions Act, historic greenhouse gas emissions in the Commonwealth, and the recent net zero emissions by 2050 goal, our current analytical and planning process towards net zero, and some examples of statewide, system-wide transformations that past research have indicated are necessary for deep decarbonization. Afterwards, we will open up the mic for you all to provide feedback if you have any. And if you can hold your questions until then, just to make sure that we have an opportunity to go through the presentation and there is sufficient time for you all to provide feedback. So the Global Warming Solutions Act was passed in 2008 to address the grave threats of climate change. Its passage made the Commonwealth one of the first states in the nation to move forward with a comprehensive regulatory program to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that cause climate change. The law requires a comprehensive science-based approach to inventory and reduce our state greenhouse gas emissions, charging the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs to evaluate the potential costs and economic and non-economic benefits of various reduction measures to the economy, the environment, public health, and using the best available economic models, emissions estimation techniques, and other scientific method. The GWSA also charges the Secretary of EEA to set a 10-year emissions limit and publish implementation plans to achieve them. The emissions limits are legally binding. The law requires that the 2020 emissions limit be between 10 to 25% below the 1990 baseline level. A 2050 emissions limit be at least 80% below the 1990 baseline, and interim emissions limits for 2030 and 2040 that shall maximize the ability of the Commonwealth to meet the 2050 emissions limit. Former Secretary of EEA, Ian Bowles, set the 2020 emissions limit at 25% back in 2010 after commissioning an analysis of greenhouse gas emissions reduction from existing policies, as well as potential additional reductions from new policies. He directed his office to publish the Massachusetts Clean Energy and Climate Plan for 2020 later that year, outlining a comprehensive suite of policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions across all sectors. Our current EEA Secretary, Kathleen Theoharides, is setting the 2030 emissions limit this year and has commissioned an analysis to inform where she should set that level, as well as what policy should be pursued to achieve it. She also intends to set the 2050 emissions limit this year, following Governor Baker's recent announcement of a net zero emissions by 2050 goal. More on these efforts a little later on in this presentation. In 2016, Governor Baker issued the Executive Order 569 establishing an integrated climate change strategy to ensure that efforts to meet greenhouse gas emissions limits are consistent with and supportive of efforts to prepare for and adapt to the impacts of climate change and extreme weather events. Key elements of the executive order was codified in the GWSA in 2018 when the governor signed a $2.4 billion environmental bond bill. Two of those codified key elements are strengthening the resilience of communities in Massachusetts and developing and implementing a statewide adaptation plan. The Municipal Vulnerability Preparedness Program is the Baker administration's grant program to support municipalities in planning for climate change impacts and implementing priority projects. Currently, 82% of the Commonwealth is participating in the program, and we've invested over $33 million across the state to date. The next funding round opens in April. You can go to our website, mass.gov, to see the contact information of your regional coordinator who can answer project-specific questions. And we also have Hillary King here, who is the regional coordinator for the Central Region. The Commonwealth is also looking to improve resiliency within its own agencies. The Resilient MA Action Team, RMAT, is the state's interagency team working to implement the State Hazard Mitigation and Climate Adaptation Plan. In its first year, RMAT has launched an online action tracker on resilientma.org to show our progress in implementing the plan, and is working to develop new climate resilience standards and evaluation tools for state agencies. So now I'm going to transition to talking about our greenhouse gas emissions. So as briefly mentioned earlier, the GWSA requires an inventory of greenhouse gas emissions to know where what emission sources are in our Commonwealth and their magnitude, as well as to establish a baseline to which emissions reduction progress can be measured. The Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection publishes a detailed annual statewide emissions inventory each year. Much of the data behind the inventory is collected locally and then aggregated by federal agencies such as the U.S. Energy Information Administration and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. This results in a 2 to 3 year lag between the end of a calendar year and the corresponding data becoming available. In 2017, which is the latest year with complete data, emissions were at 73.3 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent, which is 22.4% below the 1990 baseline level, so very close to 25%. Since 1990, Massachusetts has very successfully reduced electricity emissions due to a combination of new low-carbon generation sources and energy efficiency programs like MassSave. Direct fuel use in homes and offices have decreased per capita, but since population has grown steadily, those emissions have remained at a steady absolute level. Fuel economy standards introduced in the 2000s have also been successful in keeping transportation emissions in check, despite a steady growth in annual vehicle miles traveled. Indirect emissions from electricity consumptions are ascribed to subsectors on the basis of annual sales, so basically the hash wedges. The commercial sector is the largest user of electricity. While transitioning to a deeply decarbonized economy will require significant investment in new technologies such as zero emission vehicles and renewable energy resources like solar and offshore wind, Massachusetts' efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions have not only not held economic growth back, they have also spurred the development of an innovative clean energy economy in the Commonwealth. In 2017, Massachusetts residents and companies spent $770 billion on natural gas and petroleum, including gasoline, all of which had to be imported from other states or other countries. Transitioning our economy to run on clean or renewable electricity means that almost all of that money can stay in New England, if not in the Commonwealth. Now, we're going to transition from historical emissions to future emissions.
Great. So I'm going to share a little bit of information about the net zero emissions that we're looking out towards for 2050. So the State of the Commonwealth address this January, Governor Baker committed the Commonwealth to achieving the ambitious goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. And that is part of the request today. We're going to be we have open public comment to how we should be shaping this goal, and we're going to share a little bit of information of the framing for right now. So just starting with what is net zero emissions, it's so important that I'm putting it here twice that this graph is just illustrative. So these are not the historical numbers are consistent, but all of these near numbers are just kind of lines on a graph. But to show you where we're coming from. So what is net zero emissions? It means that the Commonwealth will need to drive down the amount of greenhouse gases that we emit into the atmosphere to a level that is equal to the quantity of emissions that can be taken out of the atmosphere. And so as you see on this graph, we've charted the 80 by 50 goal, which is the current 80% reduction from the original GWSA law. However, we're anticipating that that might need to change as we open up the public comment. But if we chart something more aggressive than 80, a deeper reduction, reduction X, there still are some emissions anticipated to be left in the economy out to 2050. However, the amount of reduction, also X, that would be sequestered in some form, the idea here is that those two are equal. So this is to achieve net zero. What we're coming putting out into the atmosphere needs to be equivalent to what we're taking back into the atmosphere. So there's a couple of ways that sequestration can happen. This this green line is again very illustrative, but we're looking at biological processes such as carbon dioxide that's absorbed by plants, physical processes, so something like biochar or carbon dioxide storage underground or in the ocean, and chemical processes. There are some kind of new technological ways, mineral carbonation, concrete that absorbs carbon dioxide, or a combination thereof. I think that we have a lot of natural resources, and so we'll talk about it later in the presentation, but we're including study of the carbon sequestration potential of the land within Massachusetts. It's a big area of study to figure out what that is, and then we'll go from there. So for the 2050 emissions limit, right now, as I mentioned, that's open for public comment. The information is at this kind of centralized website, mass.gov/2050roadmap. And I encourage anyone who hasn't been there to check it out. And we have, this is our more simplified explanation of it, but I will let you know, there's a link to a document. It's very long. There's a lot of information in here. I think there's a couple of pieces that are pulled out that are kind of the highlights of it. But if there are questions on this, we can answer. But so what we're trying to set is a level of statewide greenhouse gas emissions that is equal in quantity to the amount of carbon dioxide or its equivalent that is removed from the atmosphere and stored annually by or attributable to the Commonwealth. This is provided, however, that in no event shall the level of emissions be greater than a level that is blank. And so right now, the current law is 80%, but we're anticipating that that number might make sense to change. So right now, we're kind of putting it to public comment to hear from you on that level. And those are reductions below the 1990 baseline. And so to try to illustrate this, this was written by lawyers, so it's a little bit dense, but we're essentially, as I mentioned before, that kind of X and X, that we're making sure that what's emitted is equal to what can be sequestered. However, this backstop, this maximum allowable emissions, is what we're looking to set that number when we set the 2050 emissions. And you can see that in this example, even if we could sequester more than we emit, that backstop would say it's not, we can't emit any more than a certain backstop level. So this example over here in the red says, even though we can sequester a larger amount, if it's above that dashed line, it's not compliant. So what would that, where should we set that dashed line is the question. So you can provide comments at the end of our presentation, verbal comments and written comments can be submitted at the website, that's cited up there. All comments are to be submitted by April 10th, 2020, at 5 p.m. is the deadline for that. So I'm going to transition now to the 2050 roadmap and what we're looking at for that. And we've referenced it, and there's really what we're trying to do is thoughtfully plan for how we can achieve net zero emissions. So the goal here is to identify the strategies, policies, and implementation pathways for Massachusetts to achieve at least 80% greenhouse gas reductions by 2050 and the priorities to achieve an interim goal by 2030. And I should say that's the root goal of this cause, of this study, but that the net zero goal has kind of been overlaid on top of that. So EEA is conducting the decarbonization roadmap study, which is a long-range comprehensive study that will identify the will identify all of these things. So the study will culminate in a couple of things. So there will be a roadmap to a decarbonized Massachusetts by 2050. Really one report that is looking out to 2050 to show these are the steps we need to take to get to our decarbonization goals. We'll also that will be more of a story report, and it will be supported by at least 5 technical reports that will be much more in depth about the modeling and the assumptions and the numbers that are within that. So we'll have something that should be relatively readable and absorbable, and then the very dense but also equally exciting and important technical reports to accompany it. We'll also be setting the 2030 greenhouse gas emissions limit, which the Secretary Theoharides will be setting, and then the Massachusetts Clean Energy and Climate Plan for 2030. And so during this process, we're looking out to 2050 as our benchmark for the analysis, but we'll be honing in on actions that the Commonwealth could pursue in the next 10 years to put us on the path towards GWSA compliance in 2050. So the analysis will inform the setting of that 2030 limit and the development of this clean energy and climate plan, which is much more of a near-term kind of to-do list of policies and action for the Commonwealth to take. We're going to try our best to have as clear a path as possible out to 2050, but it's a 30-year time horizon. There's a lot of uncertainty out there. We'll talk to in a little bit in a minute. So just to give you a sense of some of the components and the timeline for the study, so it officially kicked off last July with the hiring of a consultant that is led by Cadmus Group. And we have a slew of consultants that they are working with, subcontractors. So a couple that may be worth noting, the ARUP group provided building sector analysis for the Carbon Free Boston report, and they're also working on our building sector analysis. Evolved Energy Research has done several deep decarbonization pathways for lots of different parts of North America, including the Northwest, the Midwest, the Northeast, California, and Washington, recently New Jersey. And Harvard Forest, who produced the 2013 Changes to the Land Report on Possible Land Futures in Massachusetts. So the first couple of months of the study, the consultant team was working on the technical analysis framework in consultation with EEA, as well as several of our partners, agencies, and other stakeholders. Since then, the team has been deep in the technical analysis and modeling work. We're expecting results in the next couple of months and plan to publish a 2050 roadmap and the clean energy plan by the end of 2020. And I'll just echo back to what Han said. It's a mandated deadline, so we will be publishing the 2030 clean energy and climate plan by December 31st of 2020. We've been engaging with various stakeholders through this process. We have a implementation advisory committee that is also part of the GWSA original legislation that has been meeting pretty regularly since 2012, and they have been advising on this report as well. It's made up of leaders from business, energy, environment, building, transportation, and academic communities in Massachusetts. We also have been engaging climate justice stakeholders to make sure our planning process is inclusive and the policies and strategies that will result from this are equitable. We also have been working with a team of technical advisors and an academic steering committee. We have a member of the steering committee here. Thank you very much for your assistance with this. We've also had a few other public stakeholder engagement elements, this meeting, of course, being one of them, but we also have an online forum for comment submissions kind of at any time with the study, and have been, we have other pieces of kind of public engagement planned through the rest of the study. So I think that kind of takes us through the pathway. So we are right there. This is the first of our public meetings that we're doing throughout the month of March, throughout the state. And so thank you guys for being a part of the inaugural group to hear this speech, which we will be very tired of by the end of the month. So with that, I will pass it back over to Han to tell more about the analytical process.
Great. So I'm going to walk you through our analytical process. We are examining 6 to 8 pathways to achieve net zero emissions by 2050. And by pathways, they're policy outcomes. We're analyzing what are the different policy outcomes needed to get from now to 2050. So we're using two modeling approaches. So the first one here is in bluish, and then the second one in parallel process is a parallel process. It's in the greenish colors. So we're using two modeling approaches to tackle the problem in different but overlapping ways. One team is using 5 separate sector models right here to explore deep emissions cut in each sector, and then rolling those results into an all economy emissions pathway. Emissions pathway that is analyzed in a tool called LEAP, for those who might know of that. And then another team is using a single all-economy, all-sector integrated energy demand model. Energy Pathway is called Energy Pathway. And then it's going to be run through the Rio model and to get to 5 to 7 deep decarbonization pathways for Massachusetts. We're going to then stress test this approach is being pursued by Evolved Energy Research. Claire said that they did the decarbonization analysis for Washington State, California, the country in the Northeast, Northwest, and Midwest. And then this approach here is being pursued by CADMIS Group. So we're going to stress test the pathway from the CADMIS Group to explore different effects of possible futures for different futures from now until 2050. After that analysis, we'll assess the 6 to 8 pathways and begin exploring and testing sector-specific policies with a particular focus on policies that we need to create or implement in the 2020s to achieve the 2030 emissions limit and set up deeper emissions reduction past 2030. I see some folks are taking pictures. No worries, we're going to post this slide deck online after the meeting so that you can have it and pour over it and talk to each other and others about it. We're exploring multiple pathways to identify the required near-term actions regardless of whatever possible future we encounter in 2050, and then also to identify critical decision points that we need to address as soon as possible to unlock potential and enable success in the mid to long term. This analysis would open should open as much as possible the opportunity and potential for success in achieving net zero emissions by 2050. And now I'm going to walk you through the scenario sensitivity analysis. This is the process that we use to stress test our pathway. As Claire mentioned earlier on, it's 30 years out in the future. We don't know what's going to happen. So we want to make sure that we have analytical process to understand like what are the different uncertainties that are exogenous to, I guess, our policies. So for so these four scenarios were developed after stakeholder input in from our November workshop. I'm not sure if some of you were participating in that. Definitely our steering committee members participated in that. The workshop gathered 100 or so different stakeholders around the Commonwealth to help us think about what are the different uncertainties that we should expect from now until 2050. And so based on those results, the CADMIS group have identified 4 scenarios that we will use to stress test the 4 corners, I guess, of this matrix. So here is on the x-axis, we have low social response versus high social response. And then on the x-axis, we have high technological change versus low technological change. And so these two axes are for illustrative purposes, just to give us a little framework to work with. Obviously, we're not going to test everything literally against these two axes. But the first one here is the first scenario here is uneven technological adoption. We want to see if in a world where high electricity vehicle adoptions are low due to electric vehicle adoption is high, due to low cost, and in a world where land development sprawls, continues to sprawl, renewable and storage continue to grow and at low cost, and heat electrification and building efficiency are slow, can we still get to our 2050 emissions reduction goals? And the other scenario is high inertia. We're testing if in a world where adoption of electric vehicle is slow for whatever reason, land development continues to sprawl, renewable electricity grows, heat electrification gains traction, but building efficiency does not. In this scenario, can we still meet our emissions reduction target for 2050? Same thing here for the third scenario, see here, renewable deployment. Wanted to see if electric vehicles, in a world where electric vehicles remain expensive and mode shift become more popular, and development is denser, but renewables grow slowly and at higher cost, and efficiency grows more steadily. And then the last scenario that we are testing is understanding that even though there's high technological change and high social response, if there is severe climate change impacts, the most severe impacts, can we still get to our greenhouse gas emissions reduction level? And so under this one here, comparing it to the other three scenarios, the electric vehicles and mode shift are both popular. Higher population leads to building development increases in urban, suburban, and rural areas. Renewable and storage continue to grow, and building efficiency slows due to warmer weather. So we are going to use these four scenarios to help inform the different sensitivity analysis that we will run. And the technical steering committee members will help us figure out how to use these scenarios to break into pieces for the sensitivity analysis. So that's on our to-do list in the next few weeks. So that's, in a nutshell, our analytical process and stress testing process. I am happy to answer more questions about this because I see some of you might be a little confused. So I can definitely elaborate on this later on. So now I want to transition to because our study is ongoing, we want to start talking to you about some results that we have been reading from similar studies that have been done by EER as well as other consulting groups. And so for the rest of this presentation, these are results from other studies that we are trying to see if it can be applied to Massachusetts, giving you a little flavor of what our study could say. Before we get into those, though, we wanted to give you guys a little information about the four pillars of decarbonization and net zero. So there are four primary strategies that we are pursuing to ensure we reach net zero emissions by 2050. On emissions reduction, we're focusing on increasing energy efficiency right here, switching to electrified and clean heating transportation, basically switching the end use, and expanding clean energy. There. Electrification of heating and transportation is particularly important because we can produce electricity with little to no carbon emissions using renewable technologies. Other clean energy resources and battery storage. As such, we need our end uses such as vehicles, space, and water heating, and even cooking equipment to be powered by these clean and renewable energy sources. Some studies have suggested that not every energy-using device in our economy could be electrically powered. So biofuels and other low-carbon energy resources should be reserved for these applications that are most challenging or nearly impossible to electrify. So, for example, aviation. Very hard to decarbonize the these jets and airplanes. And so biofuel might be the best option to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from these technologies. And then the fourth pillar here is increasing carbon sequestration. It's critical to achieving net zero emissions, such that any remaining emissions we have in 2050 will need to be netted out with carbon sequestered and stored permanently. It's very hard to get to zero emissions because, like I said, certain subsectors are very hard to decarbonize, like aviation. And so sequestration will be critically important to net those remaining residual emissions. So here I'm going to show you a little cartoon of what 2050 could look like in Massachusetts. Reaching net zero emissions by 2050 does not mean significantly, drastically changing our everyday life. Some of the major transitions that we expect, particularly around buildings and vehicles, achieves two pillars at once, as the move to electric is not just an emissions reduction measure, but also an energy efficiency gain. Furthermore, as the electric grid gets cleaner, there are huge reductions in the associated emissions. For buildings, our study and several studies before it are expecting that we will need more new construction, and that the population will continue to increase. The emissions from each of these buildings, will go down drastically as newer buildings will need to be built to more efficient building code standards. And over the next 30 years, many homes and businesses will undergo weatherization to have a tighter thermal envelope. The biggest emissions reduction in buildings, however, will be the replacement of carbon-emitting fossil fuels for space and water heating with electric products, such as heat pumps. While several studies have shown that not every building will be electrified to achieve an 80% emissions reduction or get us towards net zero, the vast majority of the buildings will need to be switched to electric heat pumps and other technologies. For personal vehicles, many studies have shown that in order to meet at least 80% emissions reduction targets, the total number of cars on the road can increase as long as they are powered by a clean fuel source, whether that's electric, hydrogen, or carbon-neutral biofuels or something similar. So Claire will now dig into very specific examples.
So diving more deeply into the personal vehicle, this is an example that is probably near and dear to many of our experiences every day in cars. So this is not from our study. This is from a study looking at the Northeast. We're anticipating something along these lines, looking at the transition from gasoline internal combustion engine, the acronym ICE there, may come up again. I apologize, these are taken from another report. From gasoline vehicles, which is the bulk of vehicles right now in this 2020 time horizon. This is a battery electric vehicle, and this is a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle, are the acronyms here. So we're looking at a very significant transition for vehicles to be able to largely electrify and decarbonize the transportation sector. Personal vehicles, in many ways, are one of the easier options in the transportation sector. There are currently available electric vehicles, and the utility that you see from these vehicles, they're not only electric, which is able, as Tom mentioned, to be powered by no carbon source, but they are also a lot more efficient in terms of how they work. So when we look at the total demand of for energy, when you break it down into actually how much energy is being used by these vehicles, currently we have a lot of gasoline fuel, but it's not getting us that far. Electric vehicles, by their design, are a lot more efficient. So at the end of the day, even if we're saying we need to transition, we're getting more vehicles on the road, but if they are transitioning to these electric sources, then the actual amount of electricity you need by 2050 is a much smaller amount of total energy than currently. So this is an example of achieving two of those pillars at once, that it's electrifying and it's a more efficient technology. So what we've seen in order to actually do this, kind of running the math, while some people have a car for, they lease a new vehicle every couple of years, a lot of people hold on to their cars for much, much longer than that. And so in order to, by 2050, achieve some of these really deep levels of reduction, and this, I should mention, is to get to an 80% greenhouse gas reduction is from this analysis. So if we're going beyond 80%, it's even kind of sooner and more important to do this. Several studies have shown that traditional gasoline and internal combustion engines were no longer being sold by around the mid 2030s. So somewhere around 2035, different studies have picked a different years, but at that point, no internal combustion engines were being sold for personal use. That's a pretty big transition, but this is one of the most readily available examples we have right now. And this is also showing that with more cars on the road, there are certainly opportunities, and we're studying this in our study, for alternatives to personal vehicle ownership. And so that's definitely another pathway. However, it's not, there are different use cases out there. So we're doing the numbers both ways. So I think I'll move on to how buildings are heated. That's another kind of drastic example right now. And this is, again, taken from the Northeast Deep Decarbonization Study from 2018. Well, at present, we have a most buildings are heated. These numbers are a little bit different for Massachusetts, or not too different, is what's presented here, which if you do any study of building heat sources, you'll find a lot of the materials that are looking nationwide. There's almost no fuel oil. When you look, it's almost nominal. But if you look at Massachusetts or the Northeast in general, fuel oil is a very large portion of the heating sources. So it's great to have a study that's much closer to actually Massachusetts. It's much more reflective. Within that, we have currently a large portion of gas-fired heat sources, a large portion of distillate furnace fuel oil, and we have some electric heating, which I realize is not labeled here. We should fix that. But that light blue is electric resistance, and then the rest are other. There are pellet stoves. There are other things out there that are providing heat. But the big ones here are gas and fuel oil. Unfortunately, those are fossil fuels that they're burning, and so they are very carbon intensive. Even natural gas, it's much less carbon intensive than fuel oil, but it's still a fossil fuel and burning quite a bit of carbon. And so this analysis shows a very drastic transition to out to 2050 to have the majority of heat be provided by an electric heat pump. And this is looking both at air source heat pump and geothermal heat pumps. There's also, you see that it doesn't raise that much, but the amount of electric resistance heating, especially for buildings that are already electric resistance, they're not the top priority for a transition. It would be more targeting the gas and fuel. So in this analysis, the total residential heating stock is approximately one quarter electric by 2030, two-thirds by 2040, and nearly 90% by 2050. Once again, because heat pumps are so much more efficient than other heating technologies, though, like furnaces and radiators, the overall energy demand for space heating declines in this time period. And you can see this is anticipating the stock is going up. So this is showing population growth or, you know, more buildings. We're not saying that there aren't heat sources. We're saying that's growing up to 2050. But the total amount of energy that's needed is much, much less. And the electricity, if you look at the two blue lines, you know, a much smaller amount of electricity is providing a much larger amount of heating. And that's a heat pump is just not only an electric source, but just a very efficient product. And so because of that, it's just going to be working better than legacy fuels. So we've seen that for personal vehicles and building heating, we'll be shifting to using more electricity than we do presently. That's definitely something that just about all of these studies really underline and that we're expecting to see for Massachusetts. But I think it's really important to note where is that electricity coming from and to look a little bit more into that. So looking back in time, over on the left side here, we have quite a diverse set of fuels. So from 1990 to 2017, it's changed a little bit, but not too much. But so we have natural gas, fuel oil, diesel fuel, gasoline, and renewable thermal and electric fuels, and then electricity is at the bottom, you know, somewhere around 20% is electricity. And when you're looking at, and this is economy-wide, so all the gasoline there is for vehicles too. So it's looking at all the end uses we have for energy in Massachusetts. And in 2017, when we look at where our electricity is coming from, the majority or the largest chunk of it is supplied by fossil fuels. There is some hydropower, and that little orange sliver there is renewables. They're there. They're making a difference. It's a non trivial amount, although in the grand scheme of things, it's pretty small presently. Out by 2050, we've seen in the New Jersey study, the U.S. heat decarbonization study, and for Maryland, and New Jersey and Maryland, again, are both 80 by 50 studies, so they're going down to 80% reduction. But you see that their electricity is, it almost looks like two colors. Another, we should fix that because it looks like a different line. Anyway. Sorry, you guys, this is the test bed of this slide deck. But the blue and that light blue, they're actually the same bar. The blues there are electricity. So we're seeing in the order of doubling the amount of electricity that we need. However, when we're thinking about transitioning, nearly 100% transitioning of vehicles to use electricity and of buildings to be heated by electricity, only doubling electricity demand, there is a lot of efficiency there. We also have these studies have shown some residual fossil fuels as well as some large increases in the renewable thermal and electrofuels. So to put this in perspective, a lot of change will need to happen on the electric grid side. Massachusetts has strong policies in place to achieve this change, but it's also it's going to be a lot of effort. All of this is an area where we're currently making a lot of investments as a state. So Massachusetts residents currently spend nearly $800 billion per year on fossil fuels produced in other states and countries. Again, transitioning these to these energy needs to rely on locally produced renewable energy will keep money in our local economies, and there is a lot of money. So. That is currently being spent on this. So I'll transition to Han for our last sector and then to wrap up.
So a lot of existing deep decarbonization study was looking at 80% reduction in gross emissions. And so in order to get to net zero, we have to really analyze the land sector. And so we don't have a lot of studies that we can pull from right now. So that's something that we are going to analyze in our own study, analyzing basically what the role of our forests and other natural lands can play in sequestering carbon. Luckily, in our state, we have 3.3 million acres of forest that represents about 67% of land area, not counting the water acreage. And so we believe that there's a significant potential for these natural lands to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and recognize that they also provide co-benefits such as wildlife habitat, water filtration, and retention. As of 2019, about 1.35 million acres have been permanently conserved. And so in order to make sure that we can get to net zero, we need to enhance our natural lands as much as we can, while recognizing that there are co-benefits of these natural lands that suggest, like I said, natural habitat that we need to keep in mind. We need to be able to manage these forests in a way that can provide natural habitat for our wildlife as well. So thinking about... We're wrapping up here. So thinking about the role that you play in decarbonization of the Commonwealth, to ease this transition, please consider your next vehicle be zero emissions vehicle, whether that's hydrogen fuel cell or battery electric vehicles. Also consider supporting heat pumps, having heat pumps in your homes, and also supporting denser smart growth development in your community, and as well as supporting urban forestry in your communities. So that's it. That's the end of our presentation. We have the remainder of the time, about 40 minutes, for you all to provide comments. It could be clarifying questions. It could be comments. It could be suggestions, whatever. You have up to 3 minutes to do so. And we ask that you line up in the middle of the room here. We have a mic. We'll turn it on. And before you speak, though, before you ask your question or provide feedback, if you can state your name And optional is state your affiliation, organization, whatever you want. But at least your name, so we can record it appropriately.
Yeah, that's what I mean, like you can light up, you can ask clarifying questions, probably questions, whatever questions you want, or you can provide comments and feedback that you have 3 minutes. Yeah, and up to three minutes. We'll be, so the recorder is here, it should catch us because it's on the microphone in the room, but just to get it closer, it's there. And the 3 minutes is to make sure we have time for everybody. So we won't cut you off, but eventually my phone will go off. So with that, oh, and there's plenty of snacks, so please help yourself. But come on up.
Great. And we're going to be taking notes, too.
Hi, my name is Fran Cummings from Acton, Mass. I'm a semi-retired consultant working at Peregrine Energy Group in Boston. At one time during the 1990s, I was the policy director at DOER doing an energy plan, actually under Governor Weld, who's in the news again, I see. I think you guys are doing a great job. This is really fun to listen to. I have three recommendations to make, and I have copies, which I actually emailed you them.
Yeah, thank you.
Earlier, but I'll try to be real fast. No, I have it here. I'm coming from a point of view that the climate crisis is getting worse, and we're realizing it almost daily that it is getting worse, and I don't actually think net zero by 2050 is sufficiently ambitious to protect the planet. And that's not a discussion I'm going to try to document here, but that's where my perspective. So my first point would be, I think we could define that 2050 number. There's a definition that you've asked for comment on. So my first suggestion is that the amount of emissions not be set just exactly equal to the sequestration, but equal to or less than or equal to. I think that would sort of make sense, since we're really not trying to maximize emissions up to the point we can. We're trying. The other thing is, I would recommend, rather than 80 or 85 or 90%, I would recommend 95%. I don't see why we should be expecting that far in the future that we should be almost any emissions. So unless we can really justify, you know, exactly what we can't decarbonize, I think we should be really aggressive about that. Second, in terms of 2030, I think we should be really ambitious. Everyone, the sort of conventional wisdom seems to be 45 or 50% reduction by 2030. I mean, you see that in lots of places. The state comprehensive energy plan was about 43% reduction in its most aggressive scenario. And I think instead of sort of shooting for a sort of an almost known point in 2050 and kind of gliding towards it, we should be asking how dramatically we can reduce emissions by 2030 as a sort of separate independent question. And I don't know myself whether we could get it reduced by 50, 60, 75% or more. My final point is just that in the modeling, it's really important to come up with some scenarios that are really bring 2030 down a lot, in addition to whatever happens with 2050. That we shouldn't just straight line it. We should really get that out on the table, because this process is going to give everybody a chance to really talk that through. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Tony Beatty from Keppel, Massachusetts. I'm on the MVP advisory group for the town, which is pretty exciting. And I have great news. You're missing an important piece here. Farmland. I'm a farmer. And I see, and you mentioned biochar, and biochar is a great soil amendment to increase fertility of soils. You mentioned forestry and some natural open grassland. I'm not sure you have calculated the amount of tillable land we have that's in agricultural use. And I think all of those soils, as well as lawns and backyards, can all be a real important source of sequestering carbon. including through composting. That biochar is a great way to sequester carbon. Composting organic waste is another way to get that carbon into the ground where it'll stay. My other question was on renewables. National Grid is our provider of PEPRL, and we said it was very often told that they are a barrier to increasing our amount of renewable energy, because they have their business model and renewables are a challenge for them, which I understand. And I hope that we can move all of our utility companies to be more friendly to these efforts. Thank you.
And we're in close communication with our colleagues at EEA who are overseeing the Healthy Soil Action Plan effort, and they are analyzing the carbon storage potential of different soil types, including agricultural soil.
Harry Mishkin moved to Worcester in August, and as far as involvement, I was previously involved with a group in Andover that was working to help Andover get on the community choice aggregation electricity distribution model, and as a result also attended municipal vulnerability programs. My question here is, first of all, in mentioning emission limits, you know, it's sort of quasi-suggested mandates, in other words, requirements, and I can't imagine there's any way to actually state that as a requirement, and if there were, who would it apply to, i.e. municipalities, businesses?
Yeah, I will say that, so it's a legal mandate, and so it's EEA is responsible, I think, for...
Okay, so who would it apply to? In other words, who are you mandating it to?
Yes.
Residents, businesses?
Yes, yeah, so the emissions limit in the GWSA applies to the entire state.
Yeah.
So DEP regulates different sources of pollution. So for the electric sector, they apply that to the different electricity generation facilities in the state.
Okay, so that's something real tangible, but you know, going forward, who else could it apply to? And so, you know, what you're suggesting is to make this happen, this model would involve, what, fines, penalties? I mean, how do you facilitate this movement?
Yeah, I mean, I think everything's on the table right now to make it work, but I guess I'll know the Kane legislation, or the Kane ruling was mentioned, but there's been a precedent of basically a state being sued for not complying, and so there's kind of a compliance mechanism, and that's part of what we're tracking. It's part of the greenhouse gas inventory is tracking and making sure that we are in compliance, and if we're not, there's the opportunity for stakeholders to
This, it raises another question in terms of forcing, you know, the economy to go towards renewables, which is carbon tax. I know that's been discussed, and I wonder if that's being considered at the state level. I'm not a proponent one way or the other. I just want to know if that's under discussion.
Yeah, that is something that has been raised up by our stakeholders, and that's something that we are going that is in our study analyzing the potential cost.
Okay. Can I ask one more? Public education, i.e. the folks here, everybody here is greatly aware of the incredible danger that we're all in. But if you talk to folks on the street, climate crisis, oh yeah. So in other words, raising public awareness. I'm done.
Thank you.
It's pretty intimidating.
I'm Arnie Epstein. I'm representing Elders Climate Action. I'm also the energy manager for the town of Stowmass. My question is regarding the slide that was presented early in the presentation with the definition of net zero. Mm-hmm. So, if you could go back to that. Thanks. So it looked to me, and maybe you can explain this, that in addition to adopting the net zero mandate, that you're going to adopt another mandate, which is maximum allowable emissions. Is that correct?
So we use that phrase to try to make it more understandable for the traffic. The maximal allowable emissions would be what's currently 80% reduction. So currently that dash line would be at 80, that's what's in the GWSA, and so if it moves to a different number, then that would replace that box there.
So, I mean, it seems to me, and certainly from the studies I've looked at, including the ones that you referenced, that in order to achieve net zero under, for example, the four different scenarios that you presented, the amount of emissions reduction is going to vary. And so depending on which scenario and you stress test that, you're going to find, at least these other studies have, that there's going to be more or less requirement for negative emissions or offsets. So it seems to me that by establishing a mandated maximum allowable emissions, that you've, in a sense, boxed yourself in a little bit to not allowing some of these scenarios to even take place, because under those conditions, you might be able to achieve net zero, but you couldn't achieve the maximum allowable emissions. I'm wondering why you're setting those two different goals, even though you're studying all these different scenarios.
Yeah, so if I can explain a little more about the scenario approach. The idea is that we want to, because we know the law says that the greenhouse gas emissions limit for 2050 has to be at least 80. Mm-hmm. And so we know that in whatever case, we have to try to meet that. It's just that from now until 2050, 30 years, there's a lot of uncertainties. And so while we can't change that goalpost, well, we could change it to 80, 85, 90, or whatever you suggest, the how to get to that can change. The how to achieve it can change. And so the scenario analysis the idea is to help us figure out the how.
I understand
and that could change depending on the scenario. So for one scenario that is very high inertia, for example, perhaps do we need something more stringent, more sticks, for example, sticks versus carrots.
Okay, I know my time's up.
Yeah, I'll just emphasize.
I think you should clarify.
Yeah,
I don't understand.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Well, I think this might help. That this is again, this would be the maximum we could hit, and the idea is that if we weren't able to sequester perhaps that much, then we would have to hit less than that, and we wouldn't be able to emit that much. So if we weren't able to find a source of sequestration, then the emissions would have to go down. So that's one option, but it's saying that it would be under that line, and it could not be above that line.
I guess I was really asking, and I hope I understand, it's probably not clear what I'm asking, that if you set, for example, the maximum allowable emissions to be a 95% reduction, which allows sequestration to play a relatively small role in achieving net zero. But you find yourself that as time goes on, that one of the scenarios, which is sort of low adoption of electrification or low adoption of renewable energy, isn't playing out as you hoped, but you could still achieve net zero if you allowed your maximum allowable emissions to be less than 95%, let's say 85%, and more, and you did have a means to achieve net zero through more sequestration. But it seems you would have boxed yourself in by allowing the maximum allowable emissions to be 95%.
So, yeah, the higher that number, the closer to 100 that number is, the fewer options there are. So I think that's true. So that's helpful. And yeah, you want to know. So I understand it. And yeah, thank you.
Hi. My name is Charlene DiCaligero. I'm a member of 350 Central Mass, and I'm a local official in my town of Berlin. So I basically have two problems with this plan, 2050 and a roadmap. 2050, as I believe has been pointed out, but maybe could be again, is 20 years too late. We have been told this. The, you know, evolving data says that things are getting worse faster than we thought. So there are actions in play, and the reason why I'm facing you more than I am facing the presenters is because this is really about us and what we can do. First thing is that the state legislature is really important to this process, and the governor should be pushing the legislature to pass bills like the 100% renewable energy bill. That bill seems to have been sequestered. It's not quite, you know, killed dead, but we have to make a lot of noise to make sure that gets passed. This is not something that can wait and keep getting pushed off, as it has been for years. Another thing is we need rails instead of roads. We need mass transit, which I have not really seen very much in this plan, and I am kind of shocked that there is an idea that we could increase the total number of personal vehicles, which is what I heard from this report. That is unconscionable. Unconscionable. We need to drastically expand, ramp up the frequency and the coverage of mass transit in Worcester County, and connect east and west throughout the state as well as beyond the state. We need, and I'm excited about the movement to make mass transit free here in the Worcester area. We need to spend money on this to save not just money ultimately, but our lives. Finally, it was mentioned that we need to identify critical decision points. And this is where I really want you all to be thinking and looking, which is, I think, one of the most critical decision points we can make is to find people to run for the state legislature. I am going to be running this year for state representative. We need people in office who are going to pass these bills that have been consistently blocked by legislators who do not understand or unwilling to accept the responsibility that we have in this moment. Thank you.
Thank you. There's one quick clarification I wanted to make on the vehicles, number of vehicles. That's not from our study. That's from a study of the entire Northeast, and that's the decision they decided to make for that. Again, our results are not, we haven't made those decisions yet. So just wanted to make sure that was clear on that.
Yeah, and that we are analyzing not just the transition from internal combustion vehicles to zero emission vehicles, but we're also analyzing mode shift as well.
So, yeah, mode shift meaning people moving out of vehicles and public transportation, bikes, shared vehicles across the board. So it's a big area of study and a big thing that we're testing with our MDVs. That being said, if personal vehicle ownership does go up, yeah, that's one of the things that we'll be looking at, you know, how would we react, but we're looking for policies that are do not have to encourage that. Sorry, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, that's good. My name is Gia Neswald. Thank you for doing this and having us. I'll wear two hats tonight. I'm with Wendell State Forest Alliance in Western Mass. And also involved in a campaign called No Coal, No Gas, sponsored by the Climate Disobedience Center, looking at New England electrical generation. So I was confused by a figurehead I heard that I didn't even write down because it sounded so off, about the percentage of the Commonwealth that is forested land. It's my understanding that that's 11 to 13%. So
1.3 million acres forest, 1.1 million acres forest.
Right. So anyway, I just want to share that we are now back to losing forest land in the Commonwealth. And while we can't suddenly go from 60 to zero in using forest products, we have a grave and urgent responsibility to save every tree on public land. I'm sorry, I'm cutting into your topic. I didn't mean to do that. But so forestry so far has not been identified as a greenhouse gas emission source. To put this in context, forestry is the top emission source in Oregon. It's number three in South Carolina. Why hasn't it been counted yet is one question. It's rhetorical for now. But it's a question that needs to be answered. I am wondering, in this study that is being given a lot of resources, what the alternative futures are in regard to forest management, including pro-forestation, which is hands-off management.
We can definitely answer that question. So the Canvas Group, one of their subcontractors is Harvard Forest, and they're doing this really great analysis for us, looking at a row-only scenario, and then a scenario where business as usual continues, and then a scenario where we analyze what happens if we do sustainable forestry practices, what's going to be the carbon impacts will be, because we're actually interested in this question as well, like, what happens? And then we haven't identified the fourth scenario yet for this land sector analysis, but perhaps a maybe slower adoption of different forestry practices, we don't know. It's kind of a question we hear. So if you have suggestions,
have suggestions. There's current science out there to support that the most sustainable forestry approach is pro-forestation. The language that's being promoted out of UMass Amherst via Paul Catanzano is not science, and it is being promoted as science, and he is citing old studies, and it's very dangerous to use that as a model for Massachusetts guidelines.
Yeah, I'm Morgan Mead. I'm with the Wendell State Forest Alliance also. And I'd like to point out that none of our forests are protected from logging. The DC or state forests are protected from logging permanently. The DCR can change those designations at will. A lot of the things you're talking about doing to sequester or prevent carbonization are expensive, they're happening in the future, they're complicated. Right now, we can do something for free. We can stop commercial logging on our public forests. Our mature, unmanaged forests are our frontline protectors against climate change. They should not be being cut down for private gain. We are socializing the harms of logging on our public lands, and we are privatizing the benefits. We've got to stop commercial logging in our state forests now. Thank you.
Hi, am I audible?
Yes.
I'm Ted Khanna of Worcester, and I have a history here as an environmental activist and also some background in energy conservation and solar and construction. So I want to agree with the people I've heard already saying that, you know, 80% by 2050 is probably not aggressive enough, because we just daily learn how much worse this problem is than we thought. At the same time, trying to imagine a wholesale conversion of the entire building stock within the state over the span of a few decades, it's hard for me to imagine it. I want to, but it's hard to imagine. And so, again, I'm echoing something someone else said, but we need more than just an endpoint. We need a real step-by-step a plan of how we get there year by year. What are the benchmarks? You know, if you're going to, what is that? That's 30 years away. It means we're going to get, even if you're doing it in a, just a linear fashion, not trying to be aggressive at the front end, it's 3 1/3% every single year converted. It's incredibly aggressive, and I don't see that as a society we're stepping up to devote those kind of resources to solving the problem yet. So I just would hate to see this be a visionary plan that can't actually be realistically enacted. More specifically, it used to be, when most of our electricity came from gas and oil, that the most expensive and least efficient way to heat anything was with electricity, because you would burn gas or oil at some distant power plant, and then 2/3 of the power would be lost in transmission losses before it got to the house. So you're paying 3 times as much to heat with electricity. I understand why now we want to electrify everything to get away from fossil fuels, but there's a couple of problems that, if they're not being addressed here, they need to be. The first one being, I suppose when you have more renewables and they're more local, that's one way of reducing the grid losses. You're not coming from such a distant power plant. But we do have a very antiquated grid. And if does this plan actually look at what it's going to take to get the grid up to snuff to deliver locally produced renewables in such a way that you don't have huge transmission losses? That would be one thing. A second thing, and now I'm going over because I just thought of something else, but can I have another minute or two?
Yes.
Please. Thank you. The second thing is, if you haven't looked at it, demand-side management is absolutely critical to getting electricity consumption down. It ought to be part of the plan. Now, we're talking about wireless transmission of electricity now, which sounds pretty cool, but it's grossly inefficient. So why would we do that? And there are plenty of other examples of ways. There are things we just shouldn't do at all that we're burning electricity on. That was the second thing, and what was the third thing? Yes. I'm all for getting as much renewables as possible onto the grid, but the reason National Grid, among others, is becoming a bit of a bottleneck to doing that is that renewables don't come exactly when you need them. You know, the wind is strongest in the spring, but the demand is strongest in the winter and the summer. The sunlight comes in the daytime, but the demand is strongest in the evening. So now you need a whole bunch of new storage technologies that need to be developed, and I think that also needs to be looked at as part of this plan. Because if we can't do that, it's hard to scale renewables up to the place that they're needed. Thank you.
One quick thing on the integrated grid. Is it up to snuff? That's the question. We're not going to solve every problem with the study, but it's definitely we have to switch to a more elaborate energy systems model so that we could understand better what some of those big ones are. So it's something that we're going to be looking at as much as possible, as well as that grid balancing with renewables on the grid. So it is a extra like underlying area of focus. So hopefully we will, if we don't answer the questions, we will at least figure out what questions still remain and what we're going to do to them. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Kelsey Perry. I'm a graduate student at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and I work for UMass Clean Energy Extension. I'm a greenhouse gas analyst. And I would first like to address everyone here and say that the lack of progression really has a lot to do with the people that are in this room, and I would challenge you next time to bring somebody of youth. I mean, this is at a university, and I'm one of the only students here right now, and it's intimidating, so, and I would like to ask, I do greenhouse gas inventory for UMass Clean Energy Extension. I work with the Pioneer Valley Planning Commission, and it's really hard to do my job. I have extreme lack of access to data. And I would just like to know if, I'm kind of relating back to the Green Communities Act of 2008, there's many communities still in Massachusetts that are not a green community. That was over 10 years ago, and it's because of the internal capacity of these municipalities. So I'd like to know that the state is going to give a concrete method to not only track these emissions at least every 5 years, but to also help these municipalities and bring them along with you, because, you know, the method right now is really top down. It's really inaccurate. And if we don't get greenhouse gas inventories for each town in the state, we're going to have inaccurate data and we're going to have inaccurate tracking. So I would encourage you to think about a bottom-up methodology that is not only feasible, but that all of these municipalities and students like me have access to the information that we need to complete these reports. And that's it.
That, and as we're nearing the close, and in case anyone sneaks out, I just want to highlight two things. One, please, everyone who is here, make sure that you're signed in. If you're signed in, you'll get sent the email correspondence, and we can make sure that if there are discrete things that we can help with, that we do that. And then also, it's not on here, but the mass.gov/2050 roadmap is the place to leave written comments, and so I encourage anyone who wants to further elaborate. Your comments are all noted and recorded for this, but you have the opportunity to put them there. So just in case anyone sees that, please go ahead.
Hi. I'm Alan Fierce from Stowe, Mass., also a member of Elders Climate Action, retired environmental lawyer, actually had been working with David Ismay for about 3.5 years on the roadmap bill. First thing I want to say is thank you for doing this planning. This is much of what the roadmap bill that we've been working on wants to do, and I'm so glad that the state is taking a step ahead of the bill. We hope we'll pass this year, but is getting an early start on that planning process. So thank you. That's my first thing. Could you go back to the slide that has the timeline? There you go. You know, the comment that was just made about the next time we come, bring some people along of a younger generation. Well, I don't see the next time. I see public meetings, and that's right in the middle, and that's where we are right now. So one of my questions is, when you get to the point where you're about to publish the reports, or maybe you put out a draft, will there be a public meeting at that point so we can comment on your roadmap plans? There should be. So that's request number one.
Yeah, and actually, if you don't mind, I'll just address that head on, because that's something that as I'm managing the study, I would love to do that. The timeline that we have for meeting our legal obligation of publishing it is challenging. However, a couple of things. We have the Implementation Advisory Committee, who we meet several times, and those are open in public meetings. Those are typically held at our downtown Boston office, but we encourage anyone who can participate in those to join, and those are public and notifying. And then we also are planning to do additional outreach when we have more of the kind of report published, more completion, but still further down the line.
All right, so. All right. My comment stands. Second, related to the publishing of those reports, where does this flow model go next? After the reports are published and you have a roadmap, what happens?
Does David Ismay, our Assistant Secretary, and the administration believe that the authority exists under the Global Warming Solutions Act for them to go ahead and begin to issue regulations without going back to the legislature for further authority? Is that the next step?
This roadmap process will help us come up with kind of like an actionable plan. And as part of the process, we're going to identify who are the actors and what needs to be done, and kind of classify whether we need additional authority from legislation or something that we could do ourselves, or something that we could partner with private industries or innovations, et cetera, et cetera. And so the roadmap is kind of like a long-term vision, and then it's going to boil down to really actionable 10-year implementation plan that we will implement as part of the GWSA. So it's going to be implementable.
All right. So it sounds like you think you have some authority. We hope the roadmap bill, or maybe some of the other bills down at the legislature right now, next-gen bill, will give additional authority to the administration to do what needs to be done.
I'll just add that we have legal analysis that for our legal policy analysis to make sure we're extending any regulatory authority that we have. As well as figuring out if we don't have it, what that needs to be.
Okay. I'm sorry, just one last quick comment. I think it's a great idea that you have separated the long-term 2050 emissions reduction goal from the targets for negative emissions. If you don't do that, you are encouraging laxity, that people will say, well, we really don't need to work that hard because whatever we don't get to, we'll just cover it down the road with negative emissions somehow. And I've done some research. You can go online and Google negative emissions problems. And there are states around the country that are setting this 2050 net zero goal, but they are not doing what you're doing here, and I applaud you for that. I like that. Otherwise, without that, maybe we'll get to 70% emissions reductions. Set your goal. I would encourage you to set it high. I have no faith in most of these forest projects, trading schemes. They have not worked around the world. So I'd set your goal high and not rely on much of anything from the negative emissions options that are out there now. Thank you.
Good evening. My name's Josh. I live right around the corner. I'm just here as a private citizen here. So my question concerns how the state plans to define net zero. So how are we defining our goalposts here? Does the state plan on using the existing sequestration rate of our forests to meet its goals, or do emissions offsets need to be additional to our current baseline sequestration rate? So the concept of additionality is a little complicated here, so let me give an example. So Massachusetts forests are really young, right? They're really young because we cut down all of our trees during the Industrial Revolution. So are we essentially going to give ourselves extra sequestration emissions credits because our trees are young and currently sequestering more carbon? Or does everything need to be additional to the baseline rate, i.e. reforestation? Thank you.
I'll just note, we're at time. I see three people in line, so I think that I think we'll keep going for you guys, but then I think...
Then in the interest of time, I don't ask that you respond to any of my questions. I'm just going to make comments because these people have to go. All right? So slide number 22. Spell check. I'd love electrific to be a new word, but I don't think it is. Slide number 13. Okay, we're going to talk about this emissions level. Does this include externalities? Does this include embodied energy? Does it include any of those things that would be considered part of attributable to the Commonwealth? just a question. Don't respond. It's a big question. Because if not, then you're not really attributing emissions to the Commonwealth. Those things that we buy in the store that come from China, are we paying for that? In what way? If not, why not? So define your boundaries of what is being counted as attributable to or not. Another question on this same slide, 1990, seriously? We all know that no one was tracking this in 1990. I work for Clark University as a sustainability director. We have our greenhouse gas emissions based on 2005, and we backed into that too, based on estimates. That's an estimated number. Why not take a real number, 2010, for example? Why go to this artificial place? Prior to this, we looked at some of the work that the consultants are doing. I believe that's slide number 12. No, maybe it's before that. Go back to the thing with all of your consultants, or maybe it was forward. Sorry. With your grid, your high and low.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Here we are. So as transparent as you're being by allowing these slides or this presentation be available online to the public, I'd like to see an equal from all your consultants. It sounds like you have at least four or five, if not six, plus the subcontractors that each consultant is doing. How much is that costing? What is their methodology? How are they attributing some of these definitions? How are they defining some of their goals? Where is that process happening in between you and them? Because if they're just rehashing stuff that they did in other states, and then you're, I saw a couple footnotes there saying, and this has been adjusted for Massachusetts. That doesn't help me. In what way has it been adjusted? I need the math. I need the background. And I also want to know what they're delivering and how much it's costing and where can I see their work. So I think that's all I got.
Hi. Mimi Kaplan, I'm planner at Central Mass Regional Planning Commission. So just a couple of quick comments. One is that with the state pushing electrification and air source heat pumps, so they are still quite...
One more thing, I'm sorry. What is this made of? Petroleum. Are you going to model?
With the state really promoting air source heat pumps in particular, so my family, we just installed an air source heat pump last year. We got a very small rebate. Like there had been larger rebates. I think it was about $5,000, and we got maybe a $300 rebate. It's just not affordable for your average middle class, working class family. I know people would like to install them, so I'm hoping that the state's going to be rolling out better, more comprehensive rebate program for things like air source heat pumps. And then another comment related to what she was just saying is that it would be really great if this plan was coordinated with the solid waste master plan that the DEP is developing. Okay, so things like composting, anaerobic digestion, ways of dealing with methane producing waste, and also reducing single use plastic production in general would all, I would think, just roll nicely into this. Yep. So is that something
yes.
that's happening? Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, that's, we do have a slide on it. It, the non-energy sector is small and complicated, but it's all of that element is being incorporated in our non-energy sector analysis.
Thank you.
My name is Michael Duclos. I'm from Stowe, Massachusetts. I've been an energy consultant for over 10 years designing high-performance new buildings and working in the deep energy retrofit program, affecting up to 75%, 85% reductions in existing buildings. Could we switch to the slide with the pillars on it? Yeah, that's it. Thank you. So expand clean energy. It seems to me like the crux of this entire plan, I realize there's nothing in place, just high level, is that we're going to do practically everything with electricity, and that electricity needs to be clean, that's to say renewably generated. So leaving nuclear power off the table for a moment, the two big sources that I know about is Hydro-Québec, and we're working on a transmission path through Maine right now that is not locked down yet. So what I'm going to offer you is some suggestions about risk-taking. In other words, what is the risk to the plan if that shouldn't happen? If, for example, the governor of Maine decides that isn't going to happen. Second thing is that I went to a listening session, a public town hall, by Senator Markey in Acton a few weeks ago, and someone who was there works on Vineyard Wind. And they said, oh my, the first 800-megawatt procurement is being held up because federal permitting is stopped. And so they asked Senator Markey, well, what will become of this? And he intimated that, depending on how the election goes, it will remain stopped. So that those two are things that I think you should consider in the stress testing of your plan. In other words, is there a way around this? And the sooner we recognize that perhaps we do need nuclear power, that would be something to consider, and that's going to present an enormous political and technological challenge. Because outside of those things, I don't know what else you could possibly do. Just to transition to my area of expertise in buildings for a moment, I think it was the October 23rd Global Warming Solutions Act Implementation Advisory Committee meeting. Minutes included a report from a building subworking group. I think this was in 2018, October 23rd, maybe. And on the first page, at the bottom of the first page, there were recommendations that we immediately start retrofitting and electrifying buildings in Massachusetts. And their simple math was, given 3 million buildings, we would do 100,000 buildings a year for 30 years, starting in 2020. So there's that perspective also. In other words, people are thinking about this and trying to put numbers to it, but we have such a long way to go and such a short time to do it in that they're not considering the ramp up, right? And that I consider considerable risk. So all the buildings I work on and design use air source heat pumps, and there are some issues with air source heat pumps I will just briefly mention. One is that the manufacturer's efficiency ratings are not realized in reality. And this is because the test fixture in the laboratory operates under fixed conditions, and these operate under variable conditions. The second is that proper designs aren't done because people ask for the low-cost bidder, and the design work is not done before a quote is given. Someone chooses the low-cost quote, the machine gets put in, and then it short cycles. It's too large for the situation. There are other issues. Installation quality is not assured by the licensing of the HVAC professionals who install this equipment. There are very specific guidelines and manufacturers' specifications on how the equipment must be tested to ensure refrigerant is not lost. When refrigerant is lost, it has the global warming potential R410A of approximately 1800. That has an impact. But beyond that impact is the reduced electrical efficiency. So I'd just like to back up and make the point that a pound of CO2 generated in 2020 is much worse than a pound of CO2 generated in 2030, because it has 10 more years to capture the sun's emissions and increase the temperatures. So how immediately we act and to reduce these things, and how we consider this balance, for example, with embodied energy. We know that an electric car has much higher embodied emissions. So when the battery is manufactured in South Korea and brought here, and we don't take credit for it, there's that issue. But also, that is not amortized by the clean energy that has to go into those to drive the car, to substitute for the gasoline, and how we balance those emission credits. So I'd like you to think about at least all of those for your model. Thanks very much for considering my comments.
That at this point we're going to close up the meeting, but we have the opportunity online for additional comments. There's two pieces I'll just note on the website. One is related specifically to the 2050 emissions limits, and it's a form to provide comments specifically to that, but there's also towards the bottom of the page an opportunity to provide general feedback about the study, and so I encourage if there's anything that was unsaid or you go home and it came up with another idea to submit it online. We'll also be following up, and you'll have an email for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, question? Sorry.
I'm sure it was a very brief additional comments. Could we make some
I think that staff can hear it, but the people in the audience, do as you wish. We're not going to get out of the room, so they're very brief.
I'll be really quick. Okay. I forgot to mention that the lost negative emissions of tree cutting need to be considered as emissions, and growth rates that were lost if trees were cut needs to be considered. And also, I'll come to another meeting, so I just want to plant the seed of these two questions. Our electric grid is not our own, right? It's a private, nonprofit company that runs a whole region and is making choices like committing to more coal-fired electric generation. Also, our governor is promoting and subsidizing and endeavoring to make more legislatively available biomass electric generation, which is dirtier than coal. So I'd like to know if we're going to be relying on electricity more, how those two realities can fit into this scheme, as well as our purchasing dirty electricity from outside the Commonwealth. Thank you.
And my comment comes back to the point that Jenny made about modeling. I began to dabble in carbon modeling last summer when the city wanted to force us all to put our recycling into new plastic bags, and it turned out that would have produced another 250 tons per year of CO2 out into the atmosphere. And we succeeded in talking the city out of that idea, which was a small win. But I guess my point is, I think it's important among the many approaches that we're going to take to try and reduce carbon, we ought to be talking about carbon impact modeling, getting better at it and doing it more and more often, doing it for the development proposals, transportation proposals. No, the state is constantly making big decisions that have a huge impact on consumption and emission of carbon, and we ought to be modeling more and more of that, and I would hope that that would find its way into your plan somehow. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. Feel free to grab any refreshments. And there are other meetings happening throughout the state, because you haven't seen. We do have perhaps flyers around that, but the information is online. If you have friends in other places or you want to come see the roadshow again.
Where is this online?
This map isn't, but all of the events are linked to that, this link.
The slideshow.
Oh, sorry, the slide deck is not online yet.
We'll be
posting it.
Okay.
Whenever we can get it posted.
Thank you.
Yeah, the slides
will be posted.
Thank you.
Sorry. Thank you.
We are ending the recording. You guys are doing